Hi, I'm Jose Marie Macedu, a partner at Delphi Digital. I'll be co-hosting episodes of the Delphi podcast with a broad focus on economics, governance, and incentives. With our guests, I'll explore different, sometimes radical, economic perspectives and how these affect what we value as a society and how we organize ourselves to achieve it. Ultimately, my goal with these conversations is to expand our perspectives in ways that allow us to build better systems going forward. As a reminder, nothing said on this podcast is a solicitation to buy or sell any security or token or to make any financial decisions. I or Delphi Ventures may hold tokens mentioned on this podcast, and you can see our show notes for a full disclaimer. First, a quick word from our sponsors before we dive in.
Hey, everyone. I wanted to tell you about our new podcast sponsor, LVL. LVL is releasing the first free Bitcoin exchange in North America. The LVL mobile app allows you to buy and sell Bitcoin with no trading fees or hidden spreads. With LVL, you get free Bitcoin trading, a hosted Bitcoin wallet, an FDIC-insured personal checking account, wires, checks, and direct deposits, and even a MasterCard debit card. If you use their premium account for $9 a month, you get autopilot automatic trading, chat with a dedicated private banker, and even a metal MasterCard. Check them out at lvl.co or check them out in the show notes below. Now back to our show.
Hi, everyone. Today, I'm thrilled to be speaking to Stany Kulichov, founder and CEO of Aave. Most of our listeners will be familiar with Aave, which is one of the leading DeFi protocols with nearly $3 billion in deposits and $4 billion in loans originated. An overnight success 3 years in the making, Aave, which was originally known as ETHLEND, launched with the 2017 ICO and built through a brutal bear market that saw their price drop 95% before going through a truly legendary 2020 and increasing their market cap more than 100x from $10 million to $1.5 billion today. We've worked with a lot of teams in the space and can honestly say the speed at which Aave ships and the quality of the community put them in a league of their own. Personally, I'm a Stany fanboy and have listened to most of his podcast appearances. So in this conversation, we skip over much of the now well-known Aave backstory and try to cover some new ground. I ask Stany stuff like what makes a good protocol founder and CEO, what Stany looks for as an angel investor, how he sees the competitive landscape for Aave, Aave's e-money license and plans to become a neobank, and much, much more. I hope you enjoy the conversation. And as always, please hit me up with any questions or feedback.
Stany, thanks very much for being here today.
Thanks also for inviting. Happy to be here, share my thoughts.
Awesome. Yeah, I mean, to start with, as researchers and investors in the crypto space, we're always trying to profile what a successful founder looks like. Initially, I think in the space, a lot of people were looking for the Silicon Valley stereotype. So, you know, the Stanford computer science fan company on the resume, all that kind of stuff. However, what we're seeing with you, Kane, Robert Leshner is a different kind of founder, a more crypto native founder, which is driven, you know, less fitting in a box and more so like following their intellectual curiosity. And I think your path is really like exemplifies that. So I'm curious if you could just tell us quickly what you were doing before crypto and how you ended up coming across crypto.
Yeah. So somehow finance has been always something that I'd be very, very curious. And before entering into the, you know, DeFi space or actually crypto space, I was actually way back ago, I was building Web2 financial applications. So practically what the mainstream finance calls fintech, financial technology. So which is mostly, you know, changing the interfaces, the interactions, how mainstreamers are using finance. And this is kind of like, there's a big gap that, you know, traditional legacy finance has left in what fintechs is trying to fulfill and is doing also quite a good job in that sense. And this is why different kinds of neobanks has been built. So one of the applications I had is practically allowing working capital finance to game developers, app publishers. So there's this thing when you deploy your application in, you know, in terms of traditional technology in App Store or, you know, Google Play, you practically, when you get revenue, you have to wait 30 days plus, let's say 15 days or so. So there's a waiting period, but then you have bills to pay in between. So what my application did back then is we calculated the upcoming revenue streams and then financed against that revenue for the user, for the developers to get the payouts earlier and kind of like get them to grow quicker. That was very fine. But the thing is, I was probably like 15 years old or 16 years old back then. So, you know, I was very into building things, but I wasn't very good at commercializing and making actually like, you know, products. I just wanted to build things that were very cool in terms of finance. And I was quite too young back then. So when I built various other applications, I never had an intention to actually build a startup. And actually, I went to law school. I studied in the University of Helsinki in Finland, in the Nordics, where I'm originally from. And I chose law because for some reason, you know, programming, mathematics was always about rules. Then there's this other field in finance, which is, you know, finance is very regulated. And I just wanted to understand more how that regulations and that those rules work, because they obviously work a bit different way. It's not mathematics. It's more about, you know, consensus on, you know, made by lawmakers and so forth. So I wanted to understand more. And during my studies, I think it was probably last semester or something like that, I started to get more involved in dispute resolution. And, you know, I loved contract law. And I started to research more about, you know, how we could make, you know, contracts more efficient. And somehow I started to read about Ethereum and smart contracts. And when I understood about the concept of, you know, self-executable contracts that practically, well, self-enforcement in smart contracts, that practically blew my mind. So what I realized is actually that you can make agreements between parties, you know, arbitrary amount of parties, and just those contracts are enforced as they're written. And that was like something that just practically created a lot of ideas in my head. And, you know, then I wanted to build something, and I was working with finance previously, and I wanted to create practically first on-chain lending application where the borrower has an incentive to repay the loan because of the collateral that they set there. And what was born back then was the ETH Lend, short for Ethereum Lending, which was the first lending protocol on-chain. And, you know, this, for some reason, I don't know why, but it became just like a bigger project. Like, I really wanted to just do this one thing and, you know, continue with my life, but, you know, it just escalated and somehow, you know, it became bigger and the community grew quite fast. So this was very different than I was expecting.
That's awesome. Yeah. I mean, in hindsight, your background seems like it leads perfectly to crypto, right? Like builder, finance applications, and then studying law, but I guess it was all just kind of following your curiosity and ending up here.
Yeah.
One
thing I would say that, you know, in this space, what's cool is that you find people with, you know, developer backgrounds, law, economics, you know, maybe people who are work with risk, game theory, and, you know, it all boils down, you know, together. So even like wherever you come from, you kind of try to do a bit everything. And that is where like the sweet spot is. So that it doesn't really matter what's the background. It's just like, what's your aim? And then like what ingredients you need to understand to build the product. So that was something quite nice in DeFi, because here I learned more about economics, game theory. I learned quite a lot about risk and things that I wasn't actually doing previously. And I think this is kind of like what makes the space very fascinating.
Yeah, I think that's certainly what attracted me to the space. And I think a lot of us is just a learner's paradise. There's crypto touches so many areas, whether it's economics, law, history, computer science. It's just a sort of a learner's paradise, I think. And I'm curious, you've been sort of hiring in the space for a while, but you're also an active angel investor. I think we've co-invested on a few deals on the Delphi side. What qualities do you look for in projects and in founders before investing? I mean, obviously, as we said, like founders in crypto look very different from in traditional markets. And I'm curious, like, what are your indicators that someone's a good founder that's worth backing in the space?
Yeah, I definitely kind of like the angel investments have been something pretty new to me. I've been doing them for, let's say, a year and a half, almost like 2 years. But what's important for me is, like, my investment thesis is pretty simple. I want to give as much as possible back to the ecosystem as I can and I can afford. So practically, I believe that when the ecosystem is big enough, you know, it starts to thrive in a way that the traditional finance wants to join the ecosystem and kind of like take advantage and you know, from the network effects that you can have. So it's very difficult, for example, for traditional finance to create a parallel ecosystem, for example, that is somehow replicating DeFi, but there's some properties that are tweaked in a way that it's favorable for them and might be less favorable as a kind of like an open ecosystem. And this is like my thesis. So I tried to put back capital into the space as possible, and also know-how that I received and learned during my own experience with Aave and Eatland. So the idea is that I wanted the space to grow, the ecosystem to grow, and kind of like create new opportunities. And when it comes to actually the projects itself, there's two things I'm looking into. One thing, of course, is the innovation. So what is the innovation that is at hand? So like how it improves, how it makes finance efficient, how it uses, you know, the properties of decentralized finance, you know, transparency, you know, interoperability, and for example, immutability or governance, in advantage that it makes finance better, the finance we know in traditional world, or it can be actually these days better DeFi than we used to have. And this comes to the second point that I'm looking into is usually the founder and the team, what are the capabilities of keeping up with the rate of innovation? So you can innovate as much as possible in a particular product. But the thing is that, especially in decentralized finance, anyone can participate in the ecosystem, not just by using products, but also building them. And that means that anyone in the world can build. You know, the next Aave could be created by someone from, let's say, Asia at one person, two person project, or, you know, something to that direction. So what I'm trying to look in terms of like team and founders is that how well, looking at what they're doing, how they're thinking, what they're building, how they can actually keep with the rate of innovation in the future. And this is something very important because the space is constantly moving forward. And if you don't keep up, you basically start to deflate. And this is something that is important to every founder and every builder to understand when they enter into the ecosystem, that you can build things, but if you want some long-term kind of like horizon, you need to kind of like have this constant innovation and not take it as a stressful way that you have to come up with new things all the time, but thinking it as a natural thing. So like if you're innovating constantly, and this is like part of how you design things, build things, and, you know, work on products, there will be always innovation that comes up, you know. And these are two very important things I'm looking in terms of the angel side.
That's really, really interesting. And I mean, as a protocol CEO, like we've been working with you for a few months and just seeing the sheer amount that's going on the governance forum with your e-money license, kind of all the things you have going on. I'm curious, how do you think of your role as CEO? I mean, you're the CEO, but obviously being the CEO of a decentralized protocol is a very different proposition than being the CEO of a company. And so what are some learnings that you've had on that? And how do you see the role of like a good protocol CEO?
Yeah, I think as a protocol CEO, you have to have this kind of like a, you know, stay back approach in a way that you have to kind of like make decisions and also bring topics on to the community that are in line with the decentralization goal, in the sense that you try to also take the space further. So it's not enough that you are looking like what's the current state of decentralization, you know, and kind of like stick with that. You know, as a CEO, you need to think like how we get closer to become more decentralized or more efficient in terms of what we're building on the product side, and how we get more adoption and so forth. So kind of you have to always think on what will be the next step in the narrative that you need to take to go towards these principles of decentralization and you know the efficiency that relies in in DeFi. So I think when you compare on traditional CEO position, you know, one big difference is that kind of like you are not in charge of the company. You're just, you know, one stakeholder in the protocol. So our team, the Genesis team, it's practically just one stakeholder. What we're doing very well as a team, we're basically shipping code. So we're good at shipping products, production ready, which basically means that we're shipping secure code. And that is why the community trusts us. But also the important thing is to understand that we are just one kind of a building block in the whole community. And in the future, there might be multiple teams like Aave actually building and getting their code integrated into the protocol. So kind of like you're just a member, whereas in traditional, you know, financial company, you're trying to run an objective and, you know, trying to kind of like, it's a completely different perspective, I would say. And still, it's very early. It's very hard to say like how things will evolve, but there's a narrative that you need to follow, and your guidelines are pretty much the principles that DeFi has and decentralization in general.
That's cool. And so, do you see yourself kind of deprecating your own role in a few years? Is that kind of the goal for the CEO no longer to be necessary, or do you think there will always be that role in sort of guiding all the stakeholders and being that coordination point?
I think already in the point that I'm not no longer necessary, which is a good thing for like decentralization protocol. But the thing is, I've seen like I lived the past where I've seen like, you know, very good teams building you know, protocols, whether it's you know a blockchain or practically you know application on blockchain and or a protocol there. And you know, once they have built and shipped their product, they practically give it to the community and they step back and kind of like, and they pretty much rely that the community takes the charge and so forth. But what I think is more important is that you still are part of the community. So even though like as a team, when you ship things, the community takes the charge and, you know, oversight and whatnot, it's still important that you're contributing into the protocol. It might not be code anymore if there are other teams that are doing it faster, more efficiently, and with better quality. But there's always some aspects that you should be involved. And I love to always, when I'm thinking about this topic, to think how, for example, Linux works and how Linux was founded and the role of Linux Torvalds. So which actually is funny because Linus Torvalds is also from Finland. And he basically studied in the same university as me. But what they were building also is open source, but, you know, operating systems. And still to this date, Linux Torvalds is involved in the Linux ecosystem and the community. And I think this is like good example, like how you should participate in the future, even though the protocol itself and the decision making isn't necessarily something that you are needed in, but you still should be involved because it's pretty much part of the history of the protocol. And I think especially like if you have been involved in early stages, you have a lot of things to give and in the future as well. So that's my opinion.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And it's been a massive year for Aave, to say the least. Now, kind of going to Aave, obviously you've grown. I mean, the TVL I think is close to 3 billion, market cap over a billion. And unlike others, you've achieved this without deploying any liquidity mining incentives at all yet, which is pretty huge. You've launched so many new products. I've kind of lost track of them all now with Governance V2 and everything. And you've obviously done a lot right to experience this kind of growth. But I'm curious, looking back, are there any big mistakes that you think you've made or things that you wish you'd done differently?
Yeah, I think we have more probably mistakes than you know, like, I mean... I think we make constantly mistakes, which is very normal. It's very difficult to lay out a playbook and then, you know, just follow it in a way and kind of like...
Especially in this space.
Yeah, exactly. Because, there, you know, people always love to talk about playbooks and how things should be done, you know, and you know, it's very good to standardize things. But it's important to innovate. You know, one of the things that, for example, in the beginning of 2020, I remember that when we came up with the version one of a protocol a year ago, so we had this concept of A tokens, where you know when you deposit into Aave, let's say USDC, you get in return a USDC, which is practically a representation of your deposit into the protocol, and that those A tokens practically will increase in balance in your wallet wherever you're storing. So every second the interest rate is credited to your balance, and then you can claim your underlying and the interest rate. So this was very controversial, you know, because the way that it makes very tricky to integrate the version 1A tokens. It's way easier the version 2 version. But back in the days, it was more trickier and something new. And there was big debate about whether you should do this way or you just should stick and follow the very strict form of ERC-20 standard and don't add any kind of like complexity. But we saw it as an innovation because for end user, you know, it practically meant that you have, you know, global permissionless savings account, which is, you know, kind of like credited all the time to you, the interest yield. And for us, that was like very powerful from the end user perspective. And it was done on a protocol level, not on the user interface. And we kind of like challenged the whole space a year ago that this is like, you shouldn't stop innovating things, you know, even if the whole community is against you. But if you really believe that it's helpful, it removes inefficiencies, it makes finance better, you should not listen, kind of like, I mean, you should always listen to everyone, but you should not be afraid to innovate. That's like what I'm trying to say. And we're super glad to do it. Now we have seen others are using the same concept. I saw a project that are doing like payments in this kind of like fluid balance increase way without calling the transfer function. So, and we probably will see a lot of additional things coming with the same concept. So I definitely say that we take a lot of risks in terms of like product and try different kinds of things. We fail a lot, but we also win. And those wins with big risk is what matters. You know, you need to take risks. You need to kind of like push forward. And that is kind of like receive why we were able to be successful till this point, because we try to come up with new things. Most of them will not work. Some of them will work and very well. And that risk will pay off, and it will pay off all the kind of mistakes that you do.
Yeah, that makes total sense. And definitely a lot of lessons to learn there. And digging into some of the specifics that you're working on, obviously you're kind of doing a great job serving DeFi users right now, but you've always had your eye on how can you hit like traditional users, and how can you expose more people to DeFi. And I think one of the big things that happened this year that we were super interested in is that you received your e-money license in the UK. And I think this is kind of underreported, but as far as my research showed, and please correct me if I'm wrong, the only difference between like an e-money license and a bank in the UK is that an e-money license can't provide loans or keep deposits that accumulate interest. And since you're kind of doing that anyway, it seems like you'll basically be able to operate like very similarly to a bank. I'm curious, like, what's your goal with the e-money license? Like, what can we expect next year? Are you competing with Revolut and these other neobanks directly? Is there something else? Just give us a bit of color there.
Yeah, so I think we started the process. So we have an integrations entity in UK that we launched a couple of years ago. And practically, the idea was that we have different kinds of grants and for integrations to get the protocol widely adopted. And one of the things we noticed that there wasn't easy and efficient, you know, there's always a way, but like efficient way to a end user who is holding some national currency, fiat currency, to convert into stable coins and enter into decentralized finance. And of course, when you're dealing with fiat currencies, there's the compliance and whatnot. But the main interesting point is that back then we started to work on the license, and we filed for it, and it took quite a lot of time. There was, of course, in crypto in general it's something that isn't straightforward for regulators, and also there was Brexit at the same time, and things took quite a lot of time, and also that wasn't our main focus in the sense. I mean, our goal practically is that, you know, if there's a person in that jurisdiction that actually wants to get DeFi yields, how we can make it possible without taking, let's say, 20 different steps to achieve that goal. And we decided that one of the ways that we could do is just actually get the license, and that is what we did. And today there's different kinds of on-ramps, and at some point the idea changed a bit, that, you know, especially now that when we launched the Aave protocol beginning of last year, what was interesting is that we understood, based on user experience and so forth, that many users like what we're doing on the front end as well. So we, of course, been always focusing on the protocol level to make the protocol very good, very secure, and sufficiently good documentation that it's easy to integrate. There's probably over 60 or 70 access points to the protocol, different things built on top. But one of the access points is actually a user interface that we also operate. And we have put a lot of focus on making like good UX, and we have had a lot of feedback. And based on that feedback, we've been improving, and a lot of good feedback. And kind of like we see that Aave is becoming actually kind of like a brand in DeFi. So, you know, when you deposit into Aave, you have certain kinds of expectations, you know, when it comes to, you know, user experience, you know, security and efficiency and yields even. And this is pretty funny, because the idea of decentralized finance is that you don't need to think about, you know, branding. You don't need to think about this kind of stuff. You know, it's the code, you know, you don't need to trust, just verify. But human mind is built in a way that you kind of like, once you get used to something, you establish, you know, this psychological trust. And what we understood that point is that actually, like, one of the coolest things we want to also have is the end-to-end relationship with the user, and providing the efficiency and transparency, interoperability that DeFi provides, but also ensuring that, you know, the very first touch will start from the user to us, and there's a exact end-to-end pipeline, and still the protocol is available to everyone. And so kind of like that pipeline could also be an example for others. How I don't want to use the word playbook, because, you know, in my opinion, there's no playbooks. You know, you have an objective and a goal, and you just need to innovate your way into it. But this pipeline could be just an example and inspiration for others, you know, front end or, you know, maybe, you know, centralized exchange applications, how they could plug into DeFi and you know, how they could establish this customer relationship and you know, have a customer base. And that is probably the one of the things that we are trying to expand it. And having end-to-end relationship with your user base, it's very powerful, I think.
Yeah, I think end-to-end relationship is huge. You know, that the whole Ben Thompson aggregation theory is something we look at a lot. And I'm curious, how do you see that working then? Would it be, there's like an Aave sort of application layer, and then there's the kind of protocol layer that's separate? Or, yeah, how do you see that working?
Exactly. So the protocol is decentralized. It's governed by the Aave governance, the Aave token holders, practically. So the actual application is just a access points into the decentralized protocol. In the same way that there's access points from, let's say, DeFi Saver, InstaDApp, and all the other front ends. So it just will be one additional access point that basically opens a new user group into Aave protocol, and not just Aave protocol, but in DeFi in general. So what we're doing actually here is we're unlocking a completely new market segment into your space. And for us, it's not like, even if when I talk about end-to-end, I'm practically referring to you know, the experience, you know, the experience that you have when you start from there, and that's your first touch into decentralized finance. You have the experience from you know, converting your fiat funds into stable coins and depositing, and this experience. But our goal is actually even wider. Like, once that's happened, that particular end user becomes DeFi or like crypto DeFi native user, and they can experiment everything that's happening in this space. Of course, not all DeFi is equal. You know, it's very important that in DeFi we build very secure things and still keep, you know, innovative aspects in it. And you know, that's one thing, like what we noticed in Aave is that, you know, it's very, very easy to prototype things. You can build things in hours and days, but making it production ready takes a lot of time. It actually takes months even to actually get something very, very production ready and enough diligence that you're comfortable putting it on the mainnet. And when we have this kind of like a new user segment, there's of course the educational process of educating, like, that DeFi is completely open in the sense that there's everything and you can try everything. They need to understand, like, when you're trying different things, what are the risks associated, what kind of financial products they are. And it has to be like education that they kind of like accumulate. And I think this is important part because, you know, a traditional finance works in a way that you just trust and, you know, you get certain yields and you don't know what's happening in the background. But this is not the idea of DeFi. This will happen as well. You know, people will do the same thing. But the end result here, like the objective is that people will become finance aware in what they're doing, you know, why they're holding keys, you know, and that's what we are trying to achieve here.
That makes sense. And so this application layer, it's kind of you're gonna leverage Aave, the protocol, of course, but you also see yourselves integrating kind of other DeFi protocols and other DeFi experiences and just kind of curating that for a non-DeFi user. Is that right?
Exactly. So I think, like, even though like our goal is to get more adoption for the decentralized protocol, we're super confident that you know, if you open up the user base to other activities, it creates more opportunities, it creates more traction in the space, but also creates new users because you find new things and more users come. And if everyone is doing the same thing, so if everyone is sharing users, as we're actually doing now in DeFi, so many of the Aave, you know, users actually are using other things. You know, they might use something like Wyvern. They might be using they might have a CDP in MakerDAO. So Uniswap and, you know, Paraswap, they're using all of these things, and this is what makes them, you know, creates the ecosystem. When we started with a couple of years ago, you know, into beginning of 2017, there was practically just one decentralized exchange, EtherDelta, and then when we launched, there wasn't practically anything else.
Good times. I remember EtherDelta. Yeah. That was painful UX, to say the least.
Yeah.
Nice. Okay, and as a token economist, my brain just kind of goes this way, but how do you see, like, the value capture there? Is the application layer going to have sort of an additional set of fees on top? That are going to accrue to sort of Aave, the application, or what are you, have you thought about that at all? Are you just kind of thinking of growing it first and figuring that out later? What's your plan there?
I really love the idea when you kind of like already set, you know, the token economics to a like a correct path in the very beginning. I don't like the model where, you know, like, let's just build those things and let's see later how we figure this out. I think you should be already tweaking something in the very early. And this is what we actually are doing, but we're doing it in the protocol level. So the idea is, if you look at the Aave token economics, which you've also been involved in giving feedback and modeling and so forth. So what's interesting there is that it's all about the surface of insurability, what you can insure. So one of the things we tried to figure out, like, in terms of token economics, is that what is the most important thing for the Aave community, or actually the products, the protocol itself. And one of the important things was to set the risk parameters correctly to avoid any kind of like a shortfall events, for example, failed liquidation, and also kind of like have products that are good and secure, and in terms of like when it comes to smart contract risk and so forth. So practically what we noticed that the Aave token holders are making those risk-based decisions. And the most important thing for adoption is that the protocol is secure or the depositors' funds are somehow de-risked. And what we came up is that, you know, we have the staking facility called Safety Module, where the Aave token holders, in return of making those risk-based decisions, they can stake their Aave tokens in the Safety Module and earn rewards in Aave. So practically, if there's a shortfall event, 30% of the tokens can be slashed and practically auctioned and covered the deficit in the protocol. And also if the stake doesn't cover, then there's this passive risk mechanism, recovery issuance where new Aave tokens can be minted in a similar way as the MakerDAO system had back in March last year. So practically what's the idea here is that as the protocol starts to grow, and it grows because, you know, the products are good, it's sufficiently de-risked, the surface of insurability starts to grow. So for example, when we started in 2020, we started from completely zero, and now the protocol has roughly under $3 billion worth of value locked in the protocol. So this expansion of the value locked also means that the coverage of the insurance grows, which actually should be priced into the kind of like cost of the insurance, which is practically the safety module at this point. So the incentive of the safety modules should increase to the extent as the protocol increases. And actually, this is something that the Aave governance is voting during this weekend. There's a proposal going in to actually increase those incentives so that the safety module will grow. So this means that you actually want to stake Aave, obtain and stake Aave to get the rewards to cover the depositor's risk. So the more we have front-end layers, applications, you know, it's up to the front ends to actually decide how to monetize them, and kind of like they need to monetize somehow to cover their costs, their expenses, and what's important for the protocol is that more deposits are coming in, and also there is a mechanism that, you know, we can expand the safety module and cover more of that protocol deposits in case of this shortfall events. So it has this kind of like a interesting feedback loop, you know, with the token economics, deposits, and the size of the safety module.
Yeah, this makes a lot of sense to us. Obviously, this is kind of how we think it should work as well. In that, governance decisions for a lending protocol are very much sort of like risk decisions, and so it makes sense for the people making those decisions to have skin in the game. And I think insurance is a natural way to achieve that. And then there are a bunch of questions around sort of how best to achieve that, and what we're trying to work through now, and that we'll be presenting in the call this week. But I'm curious, do you see that safety module, do you see the potential for it eventually to become almost a separate business line, like an insurance product that can also be used by potentially other protocols, but even just stuff that's built on top of Aave, like Avogadro, for instance?
I think so. And Avogadro is quite good, you know, like a testing ground for it, because the smart contracts that they have to use, let's say for getting their users to deposit to Aave, in you know, against that they're unlocking the Avogadro collectibles, is quite like narrow. So it's one interesting thing is that, of course, like the Avogadro, there will be the deposit contract on main chain, and then they have the the second layer made Matic. Actually, where you do the transactions, so you're covering also this kind of like layer two risk, which becomes quite interesting. And I think Avogadro could be a good example, like how and test how it could work in practice. But I think it definitely will form into its own kind of like insurance fund that insures the risk, and maybe there's some sort of a way that there's community auditors or tools to check what kind of contracts could be insured. And I think now there's a couple of challenges when it comes to this kind of like a business model, and well, let's say protocol business model, however you want to call it, is that now I think, for example, when it comes to safety module, all the risk is piled together, right? So in traditionally in insurance, you practically want to insure certain kind of risk. You know, you want to have insurance, let's say, if you look at decentralized finance, you want to insure smart contract risk, maybe liquidations, but you want to separate them, you know. So you want to separate what you're insuring And also kind of like that's something that we are working actually quite a lot with you guys at Delphi, because, you know, we have to figure out, let's say, what could be insured and what could be the cost of insurance, you know, if the depositor wants to deposit USDC, you know, how we could tranche those things separately, and, you know, that we don't have this kind of like common cost of everything. And this is something that needs to be solved next in DeFi in general as well.
For sure. Yeah, exactly. It has to be more granular. Just shifting gears a little bit to another like really interesting product that you've been developing for a while, delegated credit. So we see this as like a super important primitive for you, because it means that kind of Aave depositors can take advantage of other like yield opportunities in DeFi, or just yield opportunities generally, even outside of DeFi. And, you know, it kind of turns you into a yield aggregator and goes towards that goal of owning the user relationship that you mentioned. Could you explain like how delegated credit works and where the development's at there and when you see that launching, that kind of thing?
Yeah, delegated credit is quite fascinating, because it really opens a new credit extension actually in the DeFi ecosystem. So we already had it kind of like in version one. So we practically had built on top Vault, credit delegation Vault that could be used. And, you know, that was back in the times when Andre was working with us in Andre Cronje from Wyvern. And we basically created this Vault. And what's interesting in Aave version 2 is that we have credit delegation natively. And how it works is that as a user, you practically select an address you want to delegate your credit, and then you basically increase and allow once them to draw to basically borrow behalf of you. And this is very cool, because, you know, what we're working now is to make that possible in the user interface. So you could just insert someone else's address or ENS name and let them borrow behalf of you, you know, and then you can agree with the borrower like how much additional interest they will be paying you. So you'll be earning from your deposits and from your delegations. And one of the interesting thing about during the version one credit delegation was that we actually had one interesting use case where we had this kind of like a closed loop smart contract system. So you could delegate your credit to this Wyvern vault called YA Link. And practically how it worked is you deposited your A tokens there, and then that Wyvern Link vault drew credit from the Aave protocol. So it drew something like, it still actually is active, drew 15 million worth of USDC and deposited into Curve to basically farm CRV and then distribute the profits to the Wyvern Link vault shareholders. So you basically have a system here where the delegations are going to smart contracts that have one particular function, can't do anything else, and then, you know, you can draw the credit line out of there. So you don't have this kind of like a credit risk. Your credit risk is basically the smart contract
risk.
Yeah, exactly. And that is fascinating, because I believe there's going to be more of this kind of functionality. So I'm looking very forward. There's going to be a hackathon by It Global called Market Make, which we are proudly participating in. And you know, this credit delegation is something where I'm going to pitch quite a lot for developers to build. But the other part of the credit extension is that where you're delegating credit with credit risk. So practically what's fascinating here is, for example, I deposit into Aave USDC, and then let's say Ether, and I let someone else, one particular vault to draw credit line, which draws, let's say, USDC, the similar way as the Wires vault. And then they take that those borrowings and they practically do whatever they want to do. They might convert to traditional currencies and lend them out in traditional finance, or they might use these assets to market making centralized exchanges, whatever is the use case kind of like involving credit risk. Now, if there is a actual default, you know, if that credit risk actually incurs for some reason, the delegator is the one who is kind of like suffering for taking that credit risk, but the protocol will be safe from that credit risk, because there is the collateral there that the delegator actually placed. So that's a very interesting way of building this functionality, where the protocol doesn't take the credit risk. And of course, you can go even further that, you know, the protocol could even, you know, delegate credit to some whitelisted participants. And that will be the next step of this kind of like a journey narrative. But what is interesting here is that the DeFi narrative has been until this point, practically, we need more deposits, we need more capital into DeFi, you know, and that is something that will over time period push the yield rates down. And what's interesting about this credit delegation with the credit risk is that, you know, it's a way for traditional finance to actually source liquidity back into traditional finance. And over time, the liquidity might be even cheaper. It actually could be cheaper in the sense that comparing to issuing bonds or taking private placements. So you might even have a competitive edge when you source your liquidity from DeFi and put it into work in traditional finance and get competitive advantage and grow faster. So there's like so many things that you could actually play around with this. And what I'm hoping is that we see new businesses, new ways to actually and tools to assess credit risk and you put them into usage and create this kind of vaults. And I could even see them being in the Aave user interface where you have, you know, 5 vaults you can select based on different credit risk. Some are closed in systems where you don't have, and some might have a bit of credit risk and some might be fully exposed and it's up to the user.
Yeah, there's so much to unpack there. And I think one of the use cases there that we saw this year that you launched the proof of concept of that's super interesting as well is the unsecured lending using OpenLaw. We recently had Aaron on the podcast and we're big fans of OpenLaw. But how's that coming along? And do you see that as something that's kind of happening further down the line? Or yeah, what are your plans there?
I think it was pretty interesting. So we did kind of like what we did with OpenLaw is we created a kind of like a legal wrapper on one of the first like credit delegations. So diversify the borrowed 20 WBTC to practically market make for their DEX. And that was pretty interesting because, you know, there was the credit delegation wall that was deployed. But then the relationship between the lender and the borrower was kind of like wrapped into a legal agreement and signed electronically by both of the parties. And why OpenLaw is pretty cool is that when you sign the agreement, you can actually deploy the referred smart contract from OpenLaw. So you just plug into MetaMask, you sign, and then you deploy it. And you basically made a legal agreement, and then you created the actual credit delegation vault as well. And version 2, it will be even simplified. So now the credit delegation is super simple. So you practically take an address, you know, who you want to delegate the credit, and you just increase the allowance. You know, you just increase the allowance, and then as a borrower, you just borrow behalf of one user who has increased the allowance for you. So it's going to be super simple. So I think like you could use this in many use cases, and I think OpenLaw has a lot of potential, and especially like I have background also in law, and I really like what they're doing. I personally think there should be more businesses that are taking it putting more initiatives and building this kind of things. And I guess like we'll see something, but it's always slower. It's easier to deploy smart contracts than, you know, make scalable legal agreements in this ecosystem.
Yeah, of course. And I guess the legal agreements would require KYC and then potentially off-chain enforcement in case of default, right? If it were to scale.
Exactly. So it's easier when for example, if you have a party like Diversify and then you have a lender, they already kind of know each other, you know, they communicate in emails and whatnot. So they know each other. So that's kind of like KYC. There might be some additional requirements, you know, if the amounts are big and whatnot, and maybe there's some additional KYC requirements that needs to be fulfilled. But, you know, end of the day, like it's important that you identify your counterparty, agreement counterparty. So if you need a recourse, off-chain recourse, that also works. So I guess that's one of the things. That's like, I'm focusing quite a lot on things that are very core in DeFi. But, you know, this space of like between, you know, off-chain and on-chain ecosystem, this is something where we need more innovation. And the thing is that there's a lot of things to do, but I just wish there is more people working on it.
Yeah, it's I guess it's much tougher once you touch the real world, because it's no longer just sort of Ethereum's consensus. It's like legal systems consensus and legal systems interacting with each other, and often people from all over the world. So I guess that makes it tougher. But we are seeing some cool stuff, I guess, with Centrifuge and Realty onboarding real assets, which will then kind of expand the amount of credit line available. And then stuff like what you did with OpenLaw will also like expand the amount of use cases that you can actually delegate your credit to.
And I think
go ahead.
Yeah, I think what will be the kind of like moment for this kind of like innovation is when you create something very innovative where you're using DeFi and you're able to get, because of this innovation and DeFi source liquidity, you get competitive advantage in traditional finance and you know, good yielding opportunities. That will be the kind of like a moment that will spark more of this kind of like projects.
Yeah, for sure. And even if it's not like a pure sort of pricing advantage, just the ability to get a loan executed very quickly, you know, like a flash loan, I think can be sort of a superior UX and allow for very profitable opportunities that you can't take advantage of with the traditional sort of lending process.
Yeah, I mean, flash loans is definitely unique. And, you know, we read a lot of about flash loans when there's, you know, like some protocols get battle tested. But if you think about, like, there's like last year, there was like over 2 billion worth of flash loans solely from Aave protocol. So it just shows that most of the flash loans are actually used to make things more efficient in DeFi. So they're definitely, like, it's an interesting concept.
Awesome. I want to also touch base on some like competitive and kind of strategy questions to see how you think about this stuff. Because obviously the blockchain space is super collaborative. It's not zero sum. I think we all know this is going to grow like significantly before competition even becomes an issue. But obviously there are some other players in the lending space. Probably the biggest one is Compound. And although they're doing the same thing as you, you've taken very different strategic decisions, both in terms of like asset listing decisions and adding new features. And recently Compound had the pretty interesting decision of launching their own chain. I'm curious, I assume you read the white paper and stuff. What are your thoughts? Is it something that you considered before for Aave, or yeah, what do you think of what they're doing there?
Yeah, well, first touching base on the kind of like competitive advantage. And, you know, I remember there was like, was it like beginning, like end of last year, beginning of even this year, especially beginning of this year when Aave basically came to the market. And there was a lot of like discussions, mainly actually it was VC driven, you know, like discussions about competitive modes, how you create modes and what is the mode in DeFi. Is it liquidity? Is it something, you know, like mainly driven by VCs because, you know, obviously they want to protect their investments. They, you know, it's kind of like weird space where, VCs are practically doing the work of you know, like comparing different, you know, competitors, and for obvious reasons their investment is always better than others. And, you know, it's kind of like they do have a lot of time, you know, unless there's like a yield farm somewhere that they're busy. Just joking, of course. But what's interesting here is that this discussion was in place, you know. I mean, and I've never understood about the moat, competitive moat thing, because I don't think there is any moats anywhere. You know, so there's only one thing that matters. This goes back to my actually the angel investment thesis, is that it's what's important is the actual rate of innovation, like how you can keep up with the innovation and come up with new things. And if you cannot innovate, what happens is that you will have at some point your Kodak moment, and then, you know, you have to somehow get up from there. So I don't think that there's like any kind of like a way you can actually secure your position and keep that position. That's something that just doesn't work. I think what works is that you need to find constantly ideas how you improve the current status quo, make it better, make finance more efficient, you know, make it more interoperable by removing inefficiencies. And I think that's the kind of like a way to compete. And I think when it comes to, you know, what others are doing, you know, we have different kinds of approach because I guess we also like look at different perspectives. So we try to be as like collaborative as possible and be kind of like not take too conservative stances when it comes to something like, you know, like seeing new communities evolve, and you know they have good community. If they have a lot of value in that community, their you know governance asset could be used as a collateral. So we try to be very follow how different communities evolve. We're very conservative when it comes to you know listing assets in terms of like risk parameters, but we want to create those opportunities still. So innovation is one thing that drives, and also like different kinds of listing strategies, but also like we try to always remove inefficiency. I guess like there's not like any kind of direct thing what we're doing completely differently. Like everyone aims at the same thing, which is just making finance efficient, transparent, interoperable. And you know, I really love the part when like the Aave community can participate in something that is happening, you know, in Curve community, and Curve community can participate in the Aave community. For example, now Curve, they basically work very hard to actually get CRV listed in Aave. So how the Aave governance works is that there's this function called proposition power delegation. So you need 0.5% of proposition power to put a proposal on chain. Once it's on chain, you have the voting period where you need at least 2% threshold of the total supply, which practically means that when it's reached and the outcome is positive, the proposal, which is smart contract based proposal, will automatically gets rolled into the Aave protocol and the asset gets listed. So practically they campaign to get proposition power, which they get sufficiently enough to put the proposal, and the proposal passed. And that's a good example where like different communities are working together. And next, what I heard that they're doing is that they're creating a new Aave market where practically in Aave, they're putting a proposal on where there's going to be a Curve market where you can use Curve LP shares as a collateral. And that's going to be a very exciting thing. And one other community member is working on the Uniswap version 2 LP shares as a collateral. But this shows like how like the cool stuff starts to happen when people start thinking about modes, competition, and just thinking about innovation and you know, innovate together. And this reminds me like some industries have like this like you know big things that they're building. It might be like construction industry or something where you. Or it might be, you know, infrastructure where you can't do those projects by yourself, but you need other support, and you kind of like put forces together to achieve something better. And this is something that will happen more frequently this year. And we even saw it in last year with Wyrn and the partnership that they had with many protocols. So I think this is where like things will become more exciting. In terms of like layer two, I definitely think that you know, to reach scalability, you know, you have to have different kinds of security levels. You can't secure each and every transaction with the layer one. And I definitely think that the future will be multi-layer, and there's going to be like different ecosystems. You know, there's going to be different kinds of DeFi and Polkadot, and you know, and Aave just wants to be part of these different cultures. And the technical solution that we will have, we definitely have done like a lot of research, quite a lot. But we have a strategy, but we haven't announced it yet, but we'll probably announce it pretty soon.
Very interesting. And on the cross-chain stuff, do you think there's merit there and in, like interoperating with CBDCs and stuff like that? Or do you kind of just see everything's happening on Ethereum right now? We want to focus on that for right now.
We need to be careful with the central bank digital currencies because it might be even kind of like a wolf in a sheep's clothes if you think about it. Because you know the thing about DeFi and you know for example DeFi based stablecoins is that you know you have all this transparency and you have you don't have this like centralization and you know interoperability. But we don't know exactly how the different central bank digital currencies will look like. So you know, people are very excited about it. I'm excited about it as well. You know, we definitely like we want to work with this kind of technology if it's actually in line with the principles of decentralization and you know it's open, kind of like built in an open way. So I would say that I'm very excited, but also I kind of hope that it goes to the right direction because last thing we want to see is kind of like what we saw in 2017, 2018, when banks got excited about blockchain And then they started to build this permissioned, very restrictive, you know, blockchain networks that didn't lead to anywhere because you don't have the interoperability. You don't remove any like kind of like inefficiency in that sense. So like, I definitely think they will play a big role in the future, but their success is based on how open, permissionless, you know, and transparent they will be.
Yeah. Yeah. Banks like to do that, right? They did the same thing with the internet. Like, this internet thing is awesome. Let's just do this intranet thing and remove the open permissionless part. That'll work well. But yeah, I mean, CBDCs are definitely an issue. And with the stable coins, like we've been thinking about this a lot, obviously, in the context of Aave's treasury and decentralizing or rather diversifying the risk there, especially with the insurance product. But right now there isn't really like we have kind of robust decentralized options for exchange, for lending, but there isn't really that many sort of like great options for decentralized stable coins. There's obviously like USDT isn't decentralized, and it's also unclear, you know, how much they actually have in how reserve backed it is. USDC is centralized. DAI is great, but you know, with multi-collateral, arguably, like it's also become a little bit more censorable. Have you looked at any of the new sort of algorithmic stablecoin designs, and do you have any thoughts there?
Yeah, I like the idea of the algorithmic stablecoins because it kind of makes sense because in one sense, you know, you can issue shares that can be redeemed later, for example. So you have kind of like ecosystem where you have practically users that are, you know, more patient than others. So you can create kind of like a balance and you know, and with incentives, you can adjust the peg. So I think there's a lot of innovation there. And I think it will work because, you know, if it works in practice in when it comes to, you know, how treasury, you know, bonds are issued. So it should be a pretty workable solution. There's also one thing, it's interesting that many of this, they have this kind of like a token distribution mechanism and people are focusing on that. So it's kind of like... I would love to see more completely new ways of building stable coins. And there are things you still can do and actually very like scalable things. And I just think developers, they just should, you know, iterate new things. I think there's plenty of ways of creating a stable coin that doesn't exist at the moment. And I think we should see them in you know, in a testnet, mainnet at some point. Because we still kind of like have DAI, which is pretty nice, but you know, like some DAI is backed by USDC and you know, it's becoming this kind of like a very mixture of everything, which is pretty nice. It's if that's what their community wants, that's pretty interesting. And I personally use DAI as well, so I'm part of the Maker community as well, so I think it's interesting. But I would just like to see more, you know, more innovation. It's all about that. And there's still like a lot of space. Like I think it boils down to the, you know, discussion we have earlier about, you know, having this like a winner takes all attitude, you know, competitive modes and whatnot. And I think people just need to remove that from the mind and just focus on innovating. You know, that's the only thing that matters.
For sure. And you mentioned Cream before. I wanted to touch on this. Obviously, another sort of pseudo competitor in the lending space. It innovates very quickly in terms of listing assets. And recently they did this merger with Wi-Fi and are part of this sort of new Yearn conglomerate. I'm curious, have you thought about, like, what do you think of that? And did you ever think of a merger with any other protocols with Aave or of acquiring a protocol? Or what do you think of this protocol M&A stuff that's starting to happen?
Well, I personally think that's not M&A at all. I mean, when I look working a law firm, practically M&A is where, you know, you kind of like, you know, you buy shares or you buy a business, but here you kind of like have more of a partnership, I would say, right? So kind of like two protocols work together, build technology, but they still have their, you know, they still operate. You know, there's two governances, or they might take over some of the governance, but then there's still the token left from the previous. So it looks more of like a partnership, and mm-hmm. partnership like good of it. Like we work with everyone. Like for example, recently when we worked with Curve, we didn't have any kind of like official partnership. It's just like we gave them everything that they could to help and create the the proposals they wanted. And also we were working with them at the background on getting a token pool in Curve. So now you can actually, when you deposit into Aave, you get the A tokens, stablecoin A tokens, you can deposit them into Curve. And you know, you get additional interest and also you get CRV. So that's a pretty, pretty cool thing. So we were working with them on that. And there's a bunch of other stuff we're working with Zed Protocol, Balancer. I think we've worked with honestly everyone. But what's interesting here is that I don't have any like strong opinion like how, because I say just protocols working together, teams working together. And this is what I was earlier talking about, you know, when more than one protocol, you know, they start to work on something, it becomes very interesting. So that's the cool part, I think, with all of the so-called merge partnerships and everything like that is happening.
Yeah, I definitely agree with you on the M&A side. I'm curious, do you think that will happen in the future? Sort of like, for instance, token swaps or even like protocols acquiring other protocols in their communities and in a more kind of structured way?
Yeah, I mean, it's a good question. I think it will happen. You know, whatever can happen will happen in DeFi. And it can happen even sooner than later. I could imagine where, you know, there's two tokens, communities will, hey, let's vote on this. You don't even need a governance vote. You know, you could just have a smart contract where, you know, that accepts two or more tokens, and you send your token there, and it means you a new token, you know, and somehow creates a community, and that community starts to build products, and you know, it's practically born again, and there, and also you can change the ownership addresses of existing protocols. So they're actually like easy to do. The question is it worth it? I don't know. I personally think when I look at like, let's say Aave and the token economics, I try to build as much as value as possible for that particular governance, because it takes a lot of work to you know, spin up something new. So like,
for sure,
because like there's like, you know, months and years of work behind, so it's kind of like always it's always will become more difficult, and I just like simplicity.
Yeah, 100%. I think what would be interesting, and we've been kind of like, that's what got us excited about Aragon Court, was the potential for these partnerships to also become a bit more granular, where you could have, for instance, like token swaps or vested token swaps based on achieving like certain milestones, whether it's, you know, building out certain integrations or products or generating like a certain amount of volume. Yeah, that's kind of something we were excited about, but I think it's still quite early for that.
Yeah, and one thing is underrated at the moment is that, you know, you kind of always, you know, when they have this token distribution events and whatnot, you know, you basically have to bring your liquidity, but there's more than you know, capital in the DeFi space. There's so much brain work and, you know how, and you know, you know, there's many of things that people can do and build and, you know, participate, and they should be rewarded. So I think that's the next thing that should happen, so that you just don't bring liquidity, but you bring, you know, skill set and you bring people. And that's something that needs to be highlighted more.
For sure. And I think governance is becoming more and more important, and people are realizing that like governance is going to accrue a lot of value and be really important to who wins, because, you know, Bitcoin doesn't need governance. It's kind of digital gold. It's by design. But I think everything in DeFi is sort of early stage technology, and it's going to need to iterate and move quickly and make good decisions. And governance is kind of how that's done. We saw Compound, when they launched their governance contract, established kind of a standard with like Sushi and Uniswap and a bunch of others using them. And I think the launch of Aave V2 is probably going to do, Aave V2 governance is probably going to do a similar thing. You've had introduced quite a few innovations, from separating voting power and proposal power, the Guardian contracts, and a lot of that. Like, why did you decide to develop your own governance standard? And in general, do you think new projects should develop their own governance standard or use like an existing one like yours or Compound's?
I think it's always good to use something that's already exists, that is battle tested, and unless you need to innovate something. So in our case, practically what we wanted to do is we wanted to separate the you know, vote delegation and, you know, proposition power delegation. Because in our vision, we kind of saw that there's going to be, you know, like protocol politicians that you want to delegate to vote or some other parties, but also like they might not be technical. So in terms of like proposition power, you might want to delegate to someone who actually, you know, might have technical capabilities to put a proposal on chains. It could be like actor like, you know, like Gauntlet or, you know, Dharma or, for example, Delphi. So, you know, it might be that you have developers and you kind of are specialized to put on proposals, such as, for example, the tranching of the safety module risks and putting that actually into motion in a smart contract mode. And then there's other people who are, users delegate proposition power to you, and then they might keep the voting power to vote actually on the, so they're looking at the code, if it's good enough, they might vote, or then they delegate to someone else who actually makes that decision making. So that was the innovation. But the second important thing is that we went to a token swap previously during this year. So we had an immutable token, the LEND token, and now we have a token that can be upgraded, but it's very difficult. So what we introduced in the Aave governance version 2 is that, you know, we have this different kinds of voting strategies, and voting strategy is practically what token you can use to vote on certain things. So current strategy is that there is, you can vote with the Aave token, the staked Aave, and also like there is this time lock concept. So we have this short time lock for example, protocol improvements and so forth. And then we have this long time lock, which is you need very high threshold of proposition power. And also the delays are very long after the vote has finished to kind of like protect from governance attack. And we apply the long time lock on the token upgradability itself. And this is very important lesson we learned beginning of the year, and because of the token swap and everything, is that we know that, you know, there's always going to be innovation and doing a migration. If you want to innovate on a token level, which probably we'll have to do in some point. I mean, really, it's the case that, you know, you don't need to update software. Otherwise, we'll be using, you know, Windows 95 or something like that. So software is always something you improve and innovate with. And then we avoid the situation where we have to go another token migration and you know, deal all with all the logistics and so forth. So with this, we can actually continue innovating, but it takes a lot of power to make any kind of a change, a lot. And this is like the cool part. You can create these different kinds of strategies, whatever you want to achieve. And that's why I think it's very powerful governance model at the moment in DeFi.
Yeah, it's really cool. Reminds me of Jeff Bezos's type one and type two decisions. I don't know if you're aware of that framework he has, but like says that, you know, type one decisions are these big decisions like upgrading the token protocol and things that you can't go back on and that need a lot of consideration. But he says that most decisions are actually type two decisions, which can be made very quickly because actually like deliberating is less effective than just doing it and seeing what happens. And so having that at the protocol level, at the protocol governance level, I think will be super useful to encourage like quicker innovation.
Yeah, and Bezos makes a lot of decisions, so I kind of understand the concept of some of the decisions you want to make quickly. And it's actually pretty interesting to see like how someone could actually improve this model and take it further and create interesting strategies, because you can actually use the basis of this governance V2. But then you could actually create different kinds of voting strategies and just, you know, let others to also deploy and use them. And, you know, it could be something interesting. One thing we're actually deploying one voting strategy is that we're going to launch a new market within our community, and probably there will be some sort of a way that there is also voting power for the other community as well in a different kind of like way to get more like inclusiveness into the Aave governance in that particular new market, which is kind of like it's a proposal that they want to put in. So that's a good example where, you know, you can create this kind of like different strategies, and, you know, it's very flexible governance. And, you know, I think like the innovation was the key, but also the key thing was that we just wanted to think what we need at the moment, and what we needed actually is flexibility. There's always this discussion about, you know, whether you need governance or not, whether things should be immutable or not. There's so many things and related to this, like when you actually, your product is good enough that you can actually put the immutability, and also like the governance is very key. I mean, that brings the community closer together. That's why, you know, something like SushiSwap was born, and that is why Uniswap has a token now, because it really takes the governance, brings, you know, the community closer together.
For sure. And how do you see the future of that community governance? You mentioned protocol politicians, which is something we really think is part of the future as well. And do you see these as kind of paid protocol politicians that are participating in governance, or they're kind of incentivized by having their own skin in the game? And you think there's going to be a separation between the protocol politicians and the developers themselves, like a kind of a technocrat class and a politician class? Or yeah, how do you see this? How do you see this developing, and how would you like it to develop?
This is a very, very fascinating question. So, for example, from my perspective, you know, I've never been so much into politics. I'm being involved in decision making, but kind of like, you know, I personally just love to build things and let others to kind of like guide where it should go, you know, and have a wider audience on deciding things. But, you know, I just want to build more. So I think there's probably people who share similar opinion that they just want to build. And, you know, then there's other people who want to govern. And you might have this kind of like a thing, actually. And this fits well into our governance, because the proposition power is all about creating smart contract code and putting it on chain, you know, safely, securely, and so forth. And that's practically a developer's job. And then there's the decision maker's job to actually vote whether it should pass or not. And there's already kind of like things we have been taking into consideration from this perspective. But I think, you know, I think like there's no distinction between it, whether, I mean, if you're a developer, you could definitely be a decision maker and you know, and I think it's still hard to say what direction will become. I just know that there's less developers than decision makers, because, you know, everyone is a decision maker. So in that sense, that's kind of like the atmosphere. But I think not everyone cares to make decisions. But I don't know, honestly, where it will take. I think there will be paid people to run agendas. You know, definitely that will happen. It happens in real life. There's lobbying, you know, there's different things that people want to get involved. And I think it will come to the on-chain ecosystem as well.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And you already have like a pretty large amount of protocol politicians. I mean, there's very smart discussion that happens on Aave's governance forums. I mean, we had some great feedback to the first proposal, both from your team, but also from the community. And people sent us like long sort of private messages on the side as well. It's amazing how many people in the community care and also are intelligent and kind of well-educated on the issues. How do you think you develop that? Is there something you did? Do you see that there's something that you do that kind of fosters that kind of community versus other projects? Or like, yeah, how do you develop that? Are there any tips that you've learned?
I think it matured over time. You know, governance is quite a new thing for the Aave community, because, you know, I think the governance has been active for 6 months or under. And what's interesting here is that, you know, the Aave community itself has been around for 3 years or so, you know. And I think it just takes time for the community to mature, you know, and people who follow the project for year after year, they have opinion. And also, like, when you see that there's people with strong opinions, very interesting substance, you know, others are coming in as well and, you know, contributing. And I think that's probably the reason why the Aave community is very vibrant. I personally want to contribute as well. Like, I try to stay out of as much as I can, because, I mean, I don't want to influence anyone. And I think there's so many good opinions. I usually try to wait quite a long before kind of giving an opinion. And also thing is that there's so much time constraints. So like I'm such a slave when it comes to, like, you know, shipping and building. And, you know, our team is exactly kind of a bit the same. So we love to build things, you know, and you know, get new things, new ideas into mainnet. So it's always kind of like difficult to contribute, but that's good in the sense that then I don't have to, there's less risk of me kind of like influencing the community because I have social capital, which is kind of like a, in one sense, it's a good thing, but you know, in other sense, you know, it also kind of like puts trust on me, but would rather see more stronger people in the other community that like people listen more to them than me. And that's like my objective.
That's really interesting. And just my, I guess my final question, there's a lot going on at Aave, you know, from our recent kind of insurance proposal, the e-money license, delegated credit, unsecured lending, all these different like fires that you have in the coal, or coals that you have in the fire rather. And I'm curious, what are the things that you're most excited for in 2021? Like, what are your biggest kind of strategic focuses and where you want to put most of your energy?
I think what's very fascinating for me now is getting real world assets into the Aave protocol and also kind of getting liquidity out of the Aave protocol into the traditional finance. That's kind of loop is something I'm looking as well. But also I'm very curious to see like whether there could be something very innovative that we could build on top of the Aave protocol. You know, as the Genesis team and presented to the Aave community. So that is something I'm looking quite forward to because I think there's still so many things that haven't been built. And I don't know why people are always building the same things, you know, and there's just so many cool things, you know, even if you look at traditional finance, there's so many products that you could just take and make them efficient, transparent, and you know, put them into the on-chain ecosystem. So I guess like that is something what I'm looking forward, like what we could build next on top of the current protocol. And the Aave team itself is being, you know, we try to increase the team size as much as we can to kind of like have, but still keep it as lean as possible to you know, increase the rate of innovation. And the thing, the thing about Aave is that, you know, the things we build, you kind of build by yourself. It's not a one man developer thing because like the effort we put into you know, engineering, the economical part and everything, it really takes a lot of time. You could do it, but you know, it takes a bit longer, and you know, it's always difficult to build things with smaller team because you know, then you have less eye pairs into the smart contracts and so forth. So, you know, that's one of the cool things about Aave, like the product development is so amazing, and the process and everything. So it's just like if Aave will be a shipyard, it will be like very, very cool place to hang out. And you know, like that's why we probably like put so much effort because it's a very good environment for builders.
Yeah. No, for sure. I mean, the speed at which you've built this year is astounding. I'm really looking forward to seeing what you get up to in 2021, especially with the onboarding of real world assets and kind of creating those two bridges, you know, to the real world. So yeah, I really appreciate your time and all the answers. This was really interesting, and let's definitely do it again.
Awesome. Thanks for inviting me. And yeah, thank you.
Cheers.
Hey everyone. Thanks for listening to the podcast. If you enjoyed it, please support the show by hitting subscribe on iTunes, writing a review, or sharing this episode on Twitter and LinkedIn. And stay tuned for our next episode out soon.